Hello and welcome to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. I'm Kelly Taylor. Television as we know it today is multi-platform. You can, of course, watch a newscast on your TV. You can watch a show that lives on the internet and put it onto your TV. You can watch a television show on the internet and so on and so forth. But obviously, it wasn't always that way. The early days of television were very experimental, groundbreaking, and sometimes kind of dangerous, which blew my mind. And much of television history has actually been made right here in Los Angeles, as well as some big careers. Which brings me to the two guests on the show today. Joel Tater, who has produced and directed thousands of broadcasts and even wrote a book about the history of LA television. And Mitch Waldo, who is the archive manager here at KTTV, KCOP, and is also a veteran of the Los Angeles broadcast market. One of the many takeaways that I have from this conversation is that learning about the history of something, the struggle and the difficulties of the past that people endured, really makes you appreciate technology in its current form. So I hope you enjoy.
From the Fox 11 studios in Los Angeles, California, it's the Olympic and Bundy podcast with host Kelly Taylor.
So here's my first question, actually. What are both of your earliest memories of TV just in your own lives?
Well, I won't tell you my age, but when I was 4 or 5 years old, there was no TV. We got our entertainment listening to the radio, and everyone in their living room had this huge radio that they listened to. So I remember somebody coming down and saying, "Hey, the neighbor has got a television set." "What? What's that?" And we went upstairs, and there was this box, and it had a screen. The screen was about 10 inches. So if you know, now sets are, 60 inches. This was 10. So you had to get real close. And we had no idea what it was. I mean, it was brand new. Nobody knew anything about it. So that was my introduction to television. And then as these stations came on board, we're talking about 1947, 48, they came on one at a time, and they were so proud of the fact that this was a new invention that they took great joy in doing programs to explain what they were doing, how they got a signal on the air, how you could see a football game. And, I'm 7, 6, whatever it is, and I'm thinking, wow, this is interesting.
Yeah.
And I think that planted the seeds on that I would get into this business, just like a few years later, when America entered the space race and NASA came aboard, young people, everybody wanted to be an astronaut, And then a few years after that, it was the Beatles and rock and roll, and everyone wanted a guitar,
Sure.
So every time there was this a technological or cultural event happened, it inspired a lot of people. And fortunately for me, it was when television came on board.
And, schools were teaching television classes, colleges. Books came out, textbooks, a career in television. Before Channel 11 went on the air, the people who were setting up the station set up a closed circuit TV station at the Pasadena Playhouse, which was not just a playhouse, but also a school. And a lot of people coming out of the war, out of World War II, on the GI Bill, took classes at Pasadena Playhouse, and one of the things that was offered was a class in television. I mean, this was in the late 40s, and it was a new technology. It was getting in on the ground floor, and so a lot of people got there in Los Angeles, started their first exposure to television, started at the Pasadena Playhouse, where Channel 11 technicians had set up this closed circuit television station. They could learn something about TV. And growing up in Los Angeles, my first exposure, of course, was television. It wasn't really radio because I was of the generation of TV. Probably the first generation that started with television in the 50s and 60s. And, you get an identity. What your household is a Channel 4 household, a Channel 2 household, a Channel 11 household, whatever it is. You're watching programs on that one station most of the time. You're rarely flipping the channels. And I never thought of a career in TV, really. I was print-oriented until I started working in Los Angeles. I was always thinking of just selling articles.
The great thing about television in those early days, videotape was not invented until 1956. So from 47 and 48 through 56, a majority of the programs were live. And of course, you get one chance. It's like being on the stage. There's no retakes. And it was exciting to watch because more often than not, there were a lot of mistakes. And you learn, first of all, if you're in the business, you learn, but also as a viewer, which I was, you learn what went wrong and it helps you understand the whole idea of what live TV is all about.
Now, it was crude.
This bit about how television was live, the commercials, the shows, this to me was new. I didn't know that. Because I think just like when I read your book, Joel, I was like really, really fascinated because I really didn't think about even before tape the act of having to physically cut film and patch it together, like how clunky that is. And even the I Love Lucy episode of Vita Vita Vegemen, like that made so much more sense, doing the live commercials.
Well, there was some film TV, but the majority of the programs were live locally and on the network. And so that was, you know, they say the golden age. Well, one of the reasons it was the golden age is because everyone had to be at their best. The adrenaline levels had to be tops because you could only do it once. And unfortunately, tape kind of spoiled a lot of people because once they knew they could stop, they did stop. But that was a great era because you had a lot of young actors and actresses and young directors and young writers, all of whom had just would work for $40 or $50 a show. And there were no rules. It was a very experimental era, and a lot of great things came out of it, and a lot of junk came out of it. But the fact was that they gave it their very best shot, and there are some surviving shows from that era that point that out.
A lot of people who went into the motion picture business got their start in television in the so-called golden age, the original 50s, and you're right, Joel, I mean, live television, there's really nothing like it. We do it. We do it here. Mm-hmm. We do news. That's it. Sports and news, the only live television you'll ever see.
You know, it's so funny we're talking about this because I was just speaking to someone here about how live events are sort of coming back around in the sense that it used to be, as we were talking about, a lot of the things were happening live as you watch them. And then it's sort of now, when you watch primetime television, it's not as much appointment TV anymore because you can stream it or it's around everywhere. But a lot of networks have started doing those live musicals and creating these like live events that it's almost like coming back around or something.
Well, you know, it's funny because they make a big deal about it. Oh my God, we're going live, we're going live. Well, when that was the only way you could do a program, everyone got used to it and everyone went with it. You now say to a performer, an actor, or an actress, or a musician, "Hey, we're going live," and they, you know, the color leaves their face because it's terrifying that knowing that you got to get it right the first time.
Yeah, and that actually brings me to Betty White, her story, how she started. I know she did a lot of stuff, but then when she got onto the show of
Hollywood on TV,
yes, how much she was on. And it was what, like all ad lib? I mean, they didn't even have like cue cards.
No prompters.
You know what they had? They had a rough rundown. And you could, I just, for our listeners who put this up in front of the mic, but I have a director's copy of a typical Hollywood
on
television. Oh,
Mitch, you gem. Yeah, this is insane. I mean, just how much, like 6 days a week or something for hours, they're on TV and she's just off the cuff.
There was no other way. If you wanted to be on television, that's how you got on television. And that's why so many of the performers in early TV did a variety of tasks, because at any moment you might be sent out on a news story, you might have to do a live commercial, you might host a kids show. There were no, you didn't have a specialty. You were all around talent. That's what the local stations and even a lot of the network performers, you would see them in the afternoon doing a kids show and then in the evening hosting a game show and then later on they would be doing a commercial. You had to do everything and you had to run from studio to studio because if you didn't make it, they got somebody to replace
you. They had specialists who were they called them pitchmen. Well, they pitchmen goes before television. But there were people who represented a sponsor, and they would go from what they'd be, oh, let's see, I have a commercial here for the White Front department store. Got to do that at 7:15 at Channel 13, and then I have to do it over at 9:20 over at Channel 11, and then I've got to be at Channel 4. And this was their schedule, and every day they just, as you said, Jill, drive from one place to the next doing the same pitch. And they had to be on time, and they had to be on cue, and nobody had a script, so they just winged it, and they were really good. I'll tell you a real quick story. There was a local host of a record hop show, sort of like what American Bandstand was. We had it here. His name was Lloyd Thaxton. And he started as a pitchman, and he was doing his pitches for the White Front department store. And he was doing them on the Oscar Levant show, which was an evening show three nights a week at Channel 13, a late night show, very adult-oriented, nothing like it before. Oscar Levant was a terrific personality, musician, and hooked on all kinds of drugs, and that was part of his show, talking about it. So the White Front commercials, Lloyd would say, well, the good folks at White Front want you to know about the specials this week or whatever. He told me this story, so it's right from the horse's mouth. One night, Levant had activist comedian Dick Gregory on, and Thaxton said, I was listening to Oscar talk to Gregory, and it was so enthralling. Gregory was this wit, and he was so full of incredible things to say about race relations in America and all of this. This is in the early 60s. This is actually the late 50s, 1958. So Thaxton said, well, you know, I was just totally engrossed. And then Levant said, oh, it's time for the White Front commercial. He throws it to me. And he said, now a word from Lloyd Thaxton for White Front Department Stores. And Lloyd's pitch is supposed to go to the good folks at White Front. Instead, Thaxton's caught off guard. He goes, ladies and gentlemen, the white folks at, and suddenly Gregory pipes in, yes, Lloyd, what do the white folks want us to know? And this is live television. This is what really, in 1958, you know,
yeah.
It was just that kind of thing.
I'm sorry, I can't let this moment pass. I have a White Front story. I can never tell a White Front story because unless I get a lead in that, like I got from Mitch. White Front was the Costco of its time.
Okay. I was about to ask.
It was a discount department store, carried the worst collection of material, but the good prices. So KTLA, where I was working, they did a lot of breaking news. They would go out and cover news live, and it would be very expensive. So they made a deal with White Front. Every time there was a breaking news story, you needed to mention that the coverage was being brought to you by White Front. They wouldn't do a commercial, but so that everyone would think, oh, White Front is so wonderful. They're doing this for the community. So one day there was a very bad fire in Laurel Canyon. And they didn't have a reporter, so they grabbed one of the people who was on the air that was hosting a movie, and they said, get out to Laurel Canyon. And he gets out to Laurel Canyon, and he's there with the microphone, and the houses are burning behind him, and they yell in his head, said, don't forget White Front, don't forget White Front. And he says, White Front is happy to be bringing you this fire today.
Classic. What happened to White Front?
Well, first of all, during the Watts riots in 65, many of their stores were burned down because they did not treat people well at White Front. And so the White Front stores were the first to go.
But
rest in peace, White Front.
Yes.
Okay, we got to talk about Klaus Landsberg. Didn't know him. He clearly is like one of the main reasons why we're even here having this conversation, right? I mean,
For Los Angeles, he really put LA TV on the map and broke a lot of the rules and created a lot of formats and personalities and news coverage that had not existed before he got involved.
So he was responsible for doing basically everything at Channel 5.
He came to California in 1943. Paramount Pictures wanted to get into the television business because they knew that eventually it was going to overtake the movie business. Klaus was in New York. He was working for NBC, which was owned by RCA, which signed on television in America in 1939. Television started in America in 1939. They introduced it at the World's Fair in 1939. Nobody could afford a set. They weren't even making any sets. But they did say, we're here and we're going to start and this is going to be TV. And Klaus helped them with that. Anyway, Paramount hired him away and sent him to California and said, hey, we want you to start a TV operation because we want to get in the TV business. So they put him in a garage at the Paramount lot there in Hollywood. And he built the station by himself, you know, with tubes and wires and whatever and whatever. And they went on the air experimentally in 1943. In other words, they didn't have a commercial license. They couldn't run commercials. And the only people who could watch, because nobody was selling TV sets. As soon as World War II started, nothing involving television was being manufactured. Everything went for the war effort. Planes, tanks, weapons. So if you wanted to watch any experimental television, you had to build the set yourself. And a lot of people, not a lot, but some people did. They figured that in 1943, there were 300 sets in the local area here, all hand-built. He went to the FCC. He said, I'm ready to go on the air. And so in 1947, KTLA became a commercial station, which simply meant they could run commercials. And they were the first station on the air in the Los Angeles area or west of the Mississippi as a commercial TV station.
It's really, really remarkable, all the stuff he was doing, too. I mean, he was directing things. He was like the casting guy.
Yeah, he was the boss. He was really the boss of the operation.
I never met him because he died before I got to KTLA, but they say he was a real taskmaster and knew how to do every job, so if you didn't do it well, he yelled and screamed at you, but he got it done.
Yeah, I love that. There's a part in your book where you talk about how he was having to get surgeries, and he would have an ambulance transport him to direct something and then take him back to the hospital. Like,
yes.
That is dedication.
Yeah, and the real irony was that he died before videotape came in. He died before the TV helicopter came in, and when he died, he was 40 years old.
You know, the point that you raised about Paramount starting Channel 5, the birth of commercial television coincided with a Supreme Court decision that held that production companies, entities that owned motion picture studios, would have to divorce their theater chains from the motion picture studios. In other words, if you go to a Paramount theater, you're watching Paramount Pictures. You go to a Warner Brothers theater or an RKO theater or a Fox West Coast theater, you're watching product that's churned out for those theater chains by the studios. It's not the tail wagging the dog kind of a thing, but the owners were in New York, the theater chains, and the studios were here to provide content for those theater chains. The Supreme Court said, you can't have that kind of integration. Isn't that interesting? You can't have that kind of integration. You have to split them up. So the chains had to divest themselves of the studios, which is really funny because we've gone totally in the opposite direction. Well, the idea was a lot of people would read in the local press, Hollywood is totally opposed to television. Television, we're not going to let any of our performers appear in television shows. But in reality, you got Paramount starting a TV station. Warner Brothers was behind the Channel 13, RKO, later with Channel 9.
Yeah, that was actually one of my questions. So, because a lot of times actors would be just signed on to one movie studio, and they would do movies through that studio. So was it similar with television studios? I mean, was it the talent that just stayed there, or were they, because it was kind of new, they were able to kind of like bop around?
Locally, yes. But on a national level, well, there were some national stars, and they signed them up. Milton Berle, for example, had a variety show. One of the first successes went on the air in 1948. And we talk about ratings, and we talk about shares of how your audience was. the Milton Berle Texaco Star Theater, which is a once-a-week live variety show, had an 80% share, which meant 80% of the people who had TVs were watching that show. So NBC signed him to a 30-year contract, which, of course, I mean, made sense at the time. But after about 6 or 7 years of watching his show, people got tired of it, and they had to eat the rest of the contract because he wasn't as popular as he was in the beginning.
30 years.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think there's ever been anything like that. Local stations kept their personalities pretty much
So was there a lot of... Was there some bad blood between movie people and TV people?
Well, let me give you one quick example. The night that KTLA signed on the air, which was January 22nd, 1947, they had a big inaugural show, which was held on a soundstage at Paramount. They got Paramount's biggest star, Bob Hope, to host it. Another guest was Cecil B. DeMille, their biggest producer-director. So most of Hollywood ignored it. If you go back and get the newspapers for that day, it's hardly even mentioned. But every studio in town had a newsreel division, and Paramount had a newsreel division. It sent its newsreel crew to cover that opening night. They shot it, but they never aired it in the theaters because they were worried that people would start watching television and not going to the movies.
They were hedging their bets, though. I mean, they knew that television was a force to be reckoned with, and eventually they were going to have to deal with it. And getting in on the ground floor, as you said, was an opportunity they really couldn't resist, especially in light of the fact that they were losing their theaters. They had to find another way of providing, have some other platform for their content. And this was the way. I mean, television was the way. And it wasn't long before the major studios started television divisions where they would produce for television. Warner Brothers was one of the first. And Fox, of course, they all produced television programs.
The only way that Walt Disney was able to build Disneyland was he signed a deal with ABC to do a weekly television show called Disneyland and to do an afternoon show for the kids called the Mickey Mouse Club. If Walt Disney did not have that ABC money, if ABC hadn't decided that they were going to get in bed with motion picture studio, there never would have been a Disney.
We would have no Star Wars Land. We would have no Toy Story
and
Land.
And no Mickey Mouse Club, for heaven's sakes.
That actually reminds me. So did you guys watch Time for Beanie?
Well,
Mitch is too young.
I do remember syndicated. Well, they did have a syndicated version that I did see as a kid, and the animated version as well, which is.
I loved how you were talking about Albert Einstein left a meeting one time and was like, "Excuse me, gentlemen, but it's time for Beanie."
This was a cult show, and it was billed as a kids' show, but it really was more for adults because the satire and the jokes were a lot of inside stuff that young people really didn't get.
Oh, interesting. That's kind of like SpongeBob to me.
Well, there you go. It was on 15 minutes a day, 6:30 to 6:45. It was live. The puppeteers also did the voices. Uh-huh. They were very busy. They did have a script, but there was a lot of ad-libbing. They never rehearsed. They just went on and did it because there was no time to rehearse. Yeah. They all had other jobs.
So TV stations, it sounds like they had a priority to get kids in, to basically win the kids over, right?
Well, yes, because if the kids are watching TV, the parents are going to be real close by. Yes.
They're going to be like, hey, Mom, Dad, give me that for Christmas.
Well, for example, when the Today Show started in 1952, there was no daytime television until the Today Show started in 1952. One of the stars of that show was a chimpanzee. And the reason that they hired the chimp was they knew that kids would watch and their parents would watch with them. So if you see the
is that
picture,
is that who that is?
This is another chimp.
Oh, okay. Oh,
that was J. Fred Muggs
Was the chimp. I don't know who that is.
This is Hawthorne's chimp.
Hawthorne's chimp.
Jim Hawthorne, who worked at just about every TV station in Los Angeles and radio, of course, and then went on to be the program director at KFWB and then went over to KOA in Denver, had a long career in Hawaii. Anyway, Hawthorne was sort of like, they called him the Ernie Kovacs of the West Coast. He did weird things on television. This is amazing. 1950, Hawthorne has a late night show. The first late night show, by the way, goes on whenever the baseball game's finished. So it could happen at 11, had an audience. And you never knew what he was going to do on his show. It was totally unscripted. He did a lot of course, it was all ad-lib. And at some point, they brought on this chimpanzee named Sam Schmo. That's the chimp's name. So Sam has got the trainer nearby, always nearby. And they're doing this show out of an auditorium. The station used to be located, this is Channel 13, used to be located on Cahuenga. And they have an audience. Sam gets out of his enclosure and jumps up on the rafters on the lighting grid over the audience. And the audience is freaking out. I mean, they're screaming, and the handler is trying to get the chimp back down.
And yeah, I mean, I bet Sam was strong, too.
Chimps are very strong.
Had an agent, too.
And so they're trying to get this chimp down. This is live television. And the audience is screaming, and they're not laughing. And that's Hawthorne's show, is a laugh show. So eventually the trainer gets some puts. That was Sam's last appearance. However, I have this roster, station roster, lists all the people working at the television station. It was KLAC-TV in those days, KLAC-TV and radio. And so you look down this roster, 150 names or so, and you see at the very bottom, Sam Schmo has his own extension. Early television.
You know, another thing about the kids helping the parents, the first version of the CBS Morning News, which was hosted by Walter Cronkite in the early 50s, no one remembers it because it didn't last very long, but he worked with the Muppets. The Muppets were on that show with Walter Cronkite in the morning because the chimp was on NBC, so they needed something to counter J. Fred Muggs, so they got the Muppets.
Now, I was surprised. So news wasn't necessarily a priority in the beginning, right?
News for local stations and even for the networks, it was just a way to please the FCC. It was a way that you help get you a license. News never made money. They threw it away. The newscasts were 15 minutes long, 5 minutes of news, 5 minutes of weather, 5 minutes of sports. It was an afterthought. When I started at KTLA in the newsroom, we had six people in the newsroom because we did 15 minutes a day. You didn't need more than six people.
Yeah, the first big change in that really occurred in the early 60s at Channel 2 with the big news.
Oh, when they expanded to like an hour or something?
Well, they first went to a half hour, then an hour, and then longer. But this was amazing. They were marketing this newscast, and it had never been done before.
Well, what happened was that they didn't make any money on it because the ratings weren't very good. But when the big news started, all of a sudden they were getting the same kind of ratings that primetime programming got, and the station said, wow, we can make money with news.
Yeah.
So they kept expanding and expanding and expanding. I was at Channel 4 in 1968 when we did the first two-hour newscast in America. Shortly thereafter, Channel 7 went to 3 hours. I worked on the KTLA Morning News. When it started, it was 2 hours long in 1991. Today, the KTLA Morning News runs from 4 a.m. to 11 a.m. It's 7 hours long.
Yeah.
It's a money machine.
Yeah. So, I mean, I feel like that's how all the stations are everywhere.
Well,
out of curiosity, so around the time that some of these things are being tested and they're trying things, whatever, in Los Angeles, is this simultaneously happening in, say, San Francisco, Chicago, other big cities?
Yeah. In their own way.
Yeah, but L.A. and New York and Chicago are the leading markets as far as innovation. You know, thinking just about technologically speaking, just thinking about what came out of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. The helicopter over Channel 5. We had over at 5 also, actually at 2, I believe, he came up with this first, the mast camera. You mount a camera on the top of a truck mast and bring it up so you can do that. Going back further, the Zoomar lens, or the Electrozoom. You know, it was developed for motion pictures, a zoom lens. In the early days of television, you had a turret in front of your camera with maybe 3 or 4 lenses, and you'd turn the back of the camera to switch lenses, you know, telephoto, wide angle, medium. And when you did that, if you didn't have another camera to cut to, you'd see the picture roll on your screen. Very distressing to people who were having a hard enough time getting a picture. And so this fellow named Joe Walker, he was at Columbia Pictures, he was the head of the camera department over there, and a cinematographer, he developed this motion picture zoom lens. Big, you know, you take it for granted today. He tried to sell it to the people who were running what eventually became Channel 2, and they had a little studio up on the top of Mount Lee. And they weren't interested because their studio was so small, they never switched lenses and they didn't need it. But over at Channel 13, they had this huge stage and a morning show that lasted 5.5 hours. And it was a big bundle of trouble to move those cameras with the cable and everything. So they said, yeah, see if you can do it. He worked out a device that coupled his zoom lens with the camera lenses. And it was such a big hit that people came from all over the country to see this in operation. And RCA, which was selling the cameras to Channel 13 then, they sent their engineers out from Camden, New Jersey, and they said, gee, this is a great idea. And they bought a deal with this guy to produce a kit to turn to for electrozoom lenses. That was a huge development, and it happened right here in Los Angeles.
Well, the first TV helicopter in the country was developed at KTLA in great secrecy. It had the greatest name ever, the Telecopter. What a great name. Now, think about this. It was so expensive and so difficult to put together that the next TV helicopter didn't come along for 12 years.
That's so
KTLA
insane.
KTLA had the only TV live camera helicopter to itself for 12 years.
And can you explain how they were able to finagle that? Because didn't they have to have something down connected to the ground at first?
No, no. You had of course, there was a transmitter aboard the helicopter, and there was a microwave dish. And the microwave dish always had to be pointed at Mount Wilson.
Gotcha.
Because Mount Wilson was the only place. Now they have many different receive points. But in those days, there was only one. If your mobile unit or your helicopter couldn't see Mount Wilson, they couldn't get a picture on the air. So there was no wire. It was battery operated. And it was so heavy that the first model couldn't hover. Helicopters now, of course, hover. It couldn't hover because it was so heavy with batteries and with the transmitter now and the camera. Now, of course, everything's small, so they can do it. And plus, of course, now it's in color. And now there are other receive points besides Mount Wilson.
Do you feel like when stations saw this Channel 5 cooking up a telecopter, were they like, oh, no. What are we going to do? We got to do this.
No.
They
didn't want to spend the money.
You know, okay.
Yeah, the stations had fixed wing aircraft that they would fly over with film cameras, and they'd, you know, little cameras, they'd wind up, you know, like Bell & Hall IMOs or Filmos 16, and they would shoot whatever it was, they're shooting a fire or whatever, take the film back to the station or to a processing place in Hollywood, have that film souped, processed, and ready for the newscast. That was what they did.
That idea is funny to me because I was actually just talking to Josh Kaplan about how when he at one point was producing sports segments, and he say if there was a game in New York, he would have to wait for the film to be flown in an airplane to get here. I mean, just that simple, like it's so simple to get video now. That the idea of the Olympics going on in Australia in 1956, and then you have to wait 3 days to watch it is insane.
A big event. It really, I wish someone would make a movie about it. It's probably a great story. When Queen Elizabeth became Queen of England, her coronation, 1952, was a big deal. Royals still are big deals. But there were no satellites. There was no way to get the coverage of the coronation live to the United States. So what they did was each network had what they use as a kinescope, which is to say they take a 16-millimeter or a 35-millimeter camera and they shoot a monitor of a live event, in this case the coronation. Okay. Now, as soon as the coronation was over, they took each network took their own raw film. They delivered it to an airplane. On the airplane was a film developer, and there was a race across the Atlantic to see who could get it back to the United States and who could get it on the air first. And each of the planes for the three networks landed at a different spot. One was in Canada, one was in, I think, Maine, one was in Massachusetts. They would, and of course the film was ready to go, and they would take it off the plane, and at the airport there would be a projector and a microwave to get it on the air, and there was a big rush to see who could run the, and this was like 12, maybe 15 hours after the actual event, but that's the only way they could do it. Now, of course, satellites.
Like, instant. What do you think these people would say if, in some alternate universe, they were able to see, oh, I can just stream this on my phone on this tiny thing right here, instantly everyone.
Technology comes along. The telegraph came into use in the 1800s, and it was an amazing device. I mean, you almost instantaneously could get a message across the country with a telegraph. And the telephone later, and then with the wire photo, which is basically the same idea as the telephone, but you're sending a picture over the wire in tiny lines going across till it builds up. That was our very first ability to get pictures transmitted, or the wire photos, and that came along in the 20s, I think.
As soon as they invented radio in the late, 1895 or whatever it was, whatever Marconi was doing, There were a number of dreamers and a number of engineers who said, this is great. Now we have to get along with the sound. We have to get the picture. And in their minds, they were thinking of television. But it took another 30 years at least until it actually happened.
And it was a farm boy who came up with the idea for television. It was Philo T. Farnsworth who was... What is he plowing a field?
He saw the
lines.
The lines of the vegetables, yeah. And that's where
you can
scanning.
Build lines with scanning lines, and that's basically what television is. And he developed the first receivers, the first television sets, again in his own little lab, in his own little garage, in the 20s, San Francisco, in the 20s.
I want to talk about the minstrel shows. Was that at the time popular, controversial? Because it would be a lot of white actors in blackface or, how was that perceived?
Well, minstrel acts were big in vaudeville. They were big in films. The jazz singer, the first talkie, Al Jolson's in blackface. It was just part of the entertainment scene.
Gotcha. So it'd been out there.
It had been out there. So, of course, naturally, it would gravitate to be on television. There were a number of minstrel shows on local TV. KTLA had one. KTTV had one. There were probably others. It was, again, you had to place yourself in that time, which was the 50s.
Yeah.
It was not an unusual thing to be a form of entertainment.
Minstrelsy didn't really come into disfavor until about the 50s and 60s. And I'll tell you, one of the biggest protests of that era was with it's the show Amos and Andy show, which was on CBS, and met with a lot of protests by the NAACP.
It was an all-black cast.
All-black cast. And radio was two white guys.
Did the black voices.
But
for the TV, they had actually black performers, but a lot of people felt that the stereotype didn't work on television.
And TV really changed a lot of perceptions about race because, first of all, times were changing. And television was such an immediate force that if there was any social movement, television captured it.
That actually brings me to when the Watts riots were happening. There was a helicopter then,
well,
right?
Well, I must tell you that KTLA owned that story because we had the only copter. And we covered that for 5 days. And because of the Zoom that Mitch talked about, they were able to zoom in on the people who were stealing from the department stores. And at one point, the police called us at KTLA and said, you better watch out. They're going to come out. They want to burn down KTLA, because our helicopter could identify the people who were stealing.
Yeah, and this is obviously a very new thing.
Right. But other stations covered the Watts riots, but not instantaneously. And it was very difficult to be watching all of these buildings going up in flame. And it was really, and of course it happened again after the Rodney King mm-hmm. verdict and whatever. But it was a very difficult thing. But live TV really covered it.
Same thing happened in '92.
Yeah,
and again, all of the Los Angeles television stations covering with wonderful lenses and very steady shots, pulling in tight shots of people doing,
bad things.
Yeah. And all of the stations had their programming subpoenaed by the feds, going after these individuals.
They were
identifiable because the zoom could get right in close.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I remember the FBI went to every station requiring, through subpoenas, that the stations provide what they aired. And, nobody turns over stuff that doesn't get aired. But it was a major crime, and they looked at it that way, and they subpoenaed the television stations. TV has that ability to bring these disasters and these civil unrest and all of the emergencies right into the viewer's palm.
It's like for the first time, you're not just reading about something, you're not just hearing about something, you're like visually seeing all this stuff like in the comfort of your own home. I mean, that's probably super, like, just insane.
1963, December of 63, beautiful Saturday afternoon, and I was at home, and I get a call from Stan Chambers, who was the news director at KTLA. He said, some viewer called in and said that they heard there may be a crack in the Baldwin Hills Dam. I don't think it's anything, but maybe you should come in because maybe let's see what's happened. And I came in and we dispatched the telecopter, and the next thing you know, these thousands and thousands of gallons of water broke, the dam broke, washed cars and houses and people away from the Baldwin Hills. It was, and again, we were the only ones who could cover it, because the only way to cover that was with a live helicopter. You could film it, but couldn't get it on the air till later.
I remember watching that coverage, and I know that Channel 2, for instance, one of our colleagues here, former colleagues here, Pete Noyes, told the story about how they wanted to send a reporter over. They did not have a helicopter, but they sent a reporter up to the dam. The reporter's standing on the dam, and he's unable to get away. He's stuck. And they had to send someone out to rescue him. But not having a helicopter was a severe disadvantage back then.
Wow. Yeah, and I mean, what year was that?
63.
It was just
2 weeks after the Kennedy, John Kennedy assassination.
Which filled the airwaves for a couple of weeks. I remember there was, I was a young man. I was I was a kid. And there was nothing to watch on television except the funeral. That was it.
All commercials stopped. The shooting was on a Friday morning. The funeral was on a Monday afternoon. From Friday to Monday, nowhere, anywhere at any station was there a commercial. It was just wall-to-wall news coverage 24 hours a day. Now, for those of us who worked at a local station, KTLA, we couldn't manage, nor could any local station, to be on the air all that time. So all the local stations hooked up with one of the networks. We went with ABC. I don't know where Channel 11 went, but we carried the network coverage, and we would cut away for our local newscast. But otherwise, and it was tremendous cooperation because all you had to do was call up and say, can we use your picture? And they said, yes, of course.
So that was like one of the first times that you had done that.
I don't believe there was ever a time before that.
Oh,
yes, that
wow.
was the first time where we were able to use the services of the networks.
Gotcha.
Yeah, that was the first American assassination to be covered on television.
Yes.
In the 1970s, electronic news gathering, ENG, came about. Well, what have you explained why this mattered? And like, because in terms of, I know that I was reading about how when that became a thing, one of the big stories that happened was the shootout
SLA,
where they think
yeah.
Patty Hearst was being held,
yeah.
right?
Channel 2 made a decision, a very brave decision, that they were going to get rid of all of their film cameras, which had been the industry standard for everybody, network and local, and they were going to go all ENG, which is electronic news gathering, which is to say, shot on videotape, able to go live. The first story, one of the very first stories that they did was this SLA shootout. Now, it's not just the camera person, because you have a camera person, but you also, attached by a tether, you have a sound person who's carrying the recorder, who's carrying the audio equipment, and you have heavy batteries that you're carrying. You're carrying the tape recorder, and in the middle of their live cut, and they were shot at, and so they had to get out of there with all of this equipment, and it's really a very dramatic. They've saved the tape. You can see the tape. It's very dramatic. They were being shot at, but again, everyone was covering the story, but everyone else was doing it on film, which meant you couldn't get it on the air for a couple 3 hours. Channel 2 had it live.
Oh.
Yeah, that amazing. I do have the raw coverage here. We have that here at the station at
Channel 2's 11. Coverage.
Yeah, and yeah. we have some stuff from Channel 11 as well.
Yeah, well, eventually everyone got out there with live equipment, but you had
right.
you had big trucks,
setting
you had
up
big
a
cameras.
Live shot in those days
yeah.
meant a bread truck.
Yeah,
I mean,
they call it a mini cam. It's not mini at all. It's heavy, and you can put it on your shoulder, but it wasn't.
Just for someone who's like, I mean, what do you think? Like 80 pounds,
oh,
90
no,
pounds?
No, it's not that heavy. But all the gear was. But what
yeah.
you had were two people. And in the brief time I was doing some reporting in L.A., you went out with someone to shoot, someone to operate the tape deck, and a little boom, a little microphone, because the shooter couldn't do that. They were busy shooting. You had someone, and then you had your reporter. Actually, it was kind of good because he had three sets of eyes instead of just two. So in that sense, you really were looking all around you. But the battery belt wasn't that heavy. It was about 10 pounds. And then you had the deck, which was about 50 pounds.
The tape recorder.
Yeah.
yeah.
And the camera itself, which is another 28 to 30 pounds.
So you're holding all that. You're probably sweating. You don't know if you're going to be shot at or not. And
there's another person who's in the truck who is aiming the microwave dish at Mount Wilson so that if they want to go live, they have that ability to go live.
One of the stories that really stood out to me that I had no idea any background about was when they, going back probably a decade or a couple decades before, was when they were doing the atomic bomb testing and they said that it could be broadcasted in the desert in Nevada. But they hadn't done a broadcast from there. So they didn't even know if they'd have time to find microwave signals to even get it to Los Angeles.
Well,
right?
the government said, okay, if you, the television industry, want to televise this, the bomb will be going off in 3 weeks. If you want to do it, you can do it. And so the networks, of course, wanted to do it, and they called the phone company because the phone company was the one who could arrange to get the live signal from the middle of the desert to L.A., and they said, sure, we can do it. It'll take 6 months. And they said, we've got 3 weeks, and they
yeah.
said, it's never going to happen. But Klaus Landsberg, who you referenced earlier, he said, I'm going to try to do it. He said, his words were, if it's impossible, it takes a little longer. And so he had to find three mountaintops between Nevada and the studio here, so that the live picture could be broadcast, and he did, and they got it to work 1 hour before the blast went. They weren't going to change the time of the blast. The blast was going to go off whether it was televised or not. But 1 hour before it went off, they got the signal. It locked in from mountaintop to mountaintop to mountaintop to Hollywood, and they were able to broadcast it.
I mean, was this the first time that people had seen this
image? Live. Oh, no. There were films. There were plenty of films of atom bombs, hydrogen bombs.
Okay.
But this was the first time, and it frankly was terrifying to see.
I really can't imagine. I mean, the whole time that I'm reading about them, even just going around, putting the ropes down on the van to hold it down because there's high winds, they're getting all this stuff ready to go, and meanwhile, you're going to be next to an atomic bomb going off.
And the real sad irony is that not only were many of the soldiers who were there as part of the exercise, but a lot of people on the KTLA crew and Klaus himself all died of cancer way before their time. And they think it was due to the radiation from the blast.
Wow.
You know, there were a lot of experiments and a lot of firsts back then, and there was a certain amount of danger. Working with microwave equipment is dangerous. People don't realize that, but it's dangerous. Everything that we did in the early days of broadcasting had an element of danger to it. There were no rules, so to speak. This was all being written at the time. People were learning how to do this, how to work this medium. And so with the atomic blast, of course, there's a serious element of danger that is beyond just the technical. But it was just part of the pioneering effort.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the more that you learn stories like that, you really appreciate the things that people do early on for anything. I mean, for...
The important thing that Mitch said, there were no rules.
Yeah.
You made it up as you went along. And some things worked and some things didn't. I don't know, there was a swimmer by the name of Florence Chadwick. She was a long-distance swimmer, and she decided that she was going to try to set the record swimming from Catalina to San Pedro. She was going to make that swim. And Channel 4 decided they were going to cover this the whole swim from start to finish. And so they had this barge, and on the barge they had the camera, they had the a generator, they had batteries, they had the transmitter, and the only thing that they didn't have was a camera in San Pedro where she was going to end, but they thought, well, we'll get that as the barge comes in, and about 200-300 feet offshore, they lost power, and they never got to see the end of it. They never got to see the end of it. Yeah, but again, somebody had to say, hey, guess what? We're going to cover this channel swim. It's never been done before. We don't know if it's going to work, but we're sure going to try it.
I can imagine how that would just be an exciting thing just in itself. Like, oh, let's try it. Let's do it.
Exactly.
Everything that someone could imagine was tried. I mean, in 83, Channel 11 broadcast the Rose Parade in 3D.
Oh.
And you could also watch it in 2D, but you pick up the glasses and... the very fact that it seemed impossible was not really something people didn't say now or forget it. We're going to try and do it.
Channel 4, of course, is an NBC, and KFI Radio used to be an NBC affiliate. NBC didn't own it. But they thought they would get together and do the first stereo TV broadcast. And the way it worked is, the television sound was the left side of the orchestra. The radio sound was the right side of the orchestra. And if you wanted to hear the program, the orchestra in stereo, you had to set up your radio to KFI and your television to Channel 4. And that was an experiment. I remember doing it. I mean, the speaker on the radio was a little dinky little thing. The TV speaker was big, so the effect really didn't work unless you had two equal-sized speakers. But they tried it, you know? It had never been done before. Let's try it,
right.
See.
I mean, it was just that. The 1986 was the first LA Marathon. Channel 13 was looking for some kind of a sporting event to cover. They couldn't get the Dodgers, were locked out of just about everything else, and the L.A. Marathon was about to happen. So nobody wanted the marathon. Who's going to cover a marathon? Who wants to watch a marathon? Well, 13 went with that, got the contract, and used 42 cameras, brought in 250 people, had blimps, had motorcycles with cameras on them. It was an amazing thing. It was the first time a marathon had been covered in that manner, and it was incredible. And not only that, people watched it. People watched it so much that the next year and the next year, and that it kept building an audience. And it shows that when you try something new, and if it works, people will come and see it.
KTLA did the first coverage of the Rose Parade back in the 40s. They got color equipment in 55. And so what they did was that they did the first part, they did the parade, first part of it in black and white. Then Klaus Landsberg and the announcers got into a police vehicle, went down to the end of the route as the beginning of the parade got there, and that's where the color cameras were set up. So they did the parade at the end in color.
That reminds me, when did you guys first get color television?
You mean station-wise?
Personally.
In our homes?
Yeah, in your homes.
1960.
67 for us.
Did it, like, blow your mind? Or were you kind of like, oh, no, finally?
The first time I saw color TV was at an appliance store in 1955 for Peter Pan. They did Peter Pan in color.
That's a peanut butter brand.
Now it's, Peter Pan. And the appliance store had set up chairs there in the store, and the screen was probably 20 inches, and everyone, you know, was squinting to see it. And NBC didn't have a peacock in those days. It just came up, and it just said, the following program is brought to you in color, and wow, it just blew your mind.
NBC did a lot of color. They were first network to do it, and they had a show here in Los Angeles called, I think it was, Matinee Theater?
Matinee Theater.
Matinee Theater was a daily 15-minute...
No, 60-minute.
60-minute show. It was 60-minute little playlets. Little
dramatic show.
In color.
Yeah.
And so there was a director, a fellow named Rudy Belmer, who was working at 13 and who eventually went on to do other things. And he was a director at Channel 13. And the local stations were doing, of course, black and white. He wanted to see what it was like to direct a color television show, because it was that new. It wasn't something that really most of the audience had ever seen. So he, and it tells you how easy it was, but how really small things were. NBC had just moved into Burbank, Color City. That was studios, Color City. And he snuck on, he just walked onto the lot and carried a briefcase and wore a suit, and they thought he was a sponsor. And they let him in, he got up into the booth to watch them direct this show. It was that exciting for people.
I was actually talking to a woman about this recently, and she was saying how when she got a color TV in the 70s, she almost viewed the shows that she liked in a totally different light, because finally now she saw, oh, you mean she's got red hair? Oh, you mean that's the colors of the living room. Do you know what I mean? It was like so much more depth to the shows that she was watching.
Color really didn't take off until, I mean, for a lot of people, till the 70s. I mean, the first color broadcast actually was the NBC did the Tournament of Roses parade in 54. So they had the equipment in 54, actually in 53, but it was, sets were expensive, and people said, oh, we'll wait till it gets fixed, you know, it'll be perfect. It really started taking off in the 70s, a lot of people.
I love the story about how there was a potato chip company.
That was Klaus, yes.
And
Klaus,
he was colorblind?
Klaus was colorblind, and they were doing a live commercial for a potato chip company, and he kept saying to the engineer, I won't do his accent. He had a German accent, but he said, no, more yellow, more yellow. And of course, it turned out to be green. And so the sponsor had to sit there and watch the green potato chip commercial go out on the air.
But he just couldn't tell because it was
commercials. Later, when the color was starting to come in more regular way in the late 50s, early 60s, commercials were seemed to be always in color. All the other programming might have been black and white. The commercials were in color. But I know travel logs, very big deal, because everybody was, you know, shooting color film on these travel logs. And this goes back to the, oh gosh, to the Chautauqua days, you know, when they put on a show and show slides and show a picture. Well, television was one of the first to use color for travel logs. And oftentimes, the studio cameras were black and white, but their film chains were color. So they'd have the host in black and white, and then they'd show the bit of the travel and, you know, wherever they had gone, and that would be in color. And they would always advertise in color, color, color. Every, you look in those TV guides, it's color, color. It's, I know, for someone who didn't grow up, but you see, it's all black and white, and to see something in color was a big sales
I just
point.
Can't imagine going back. Like, if you see something in color, and then going back to watch something in black and white, it just wouldn't be the same.
No. You know, when we, Gene Autry bought KTLA in 1964 from Paramount, and so he bought some new color equipment. It was a bus that could do studio stuff and then go do remotes. And of course, he owned the Angel game, owned the Los Angeles Angels. Well, we would do the news in color, but when there was an Angel game, they would take the bus to Anaheim for the game, and the newscaster, George Putnam at the time, would come on and say, "Well, today we're in beautiful black and white because Mr. Autry wants to show the ball game in color." He made a big deal about it. Gene did not appreciate that.
Oh, my gosh. I loved reading about a lot of the people that, because I'm not originally from here, so I don't, I mean, even now, I had to really work to learn everyone's names on all the news stations here and whatnot. And I loved reading about a lot of the people, like just even, I think it was during, there was a three-year-old that fell down a well. And
yes.
Kathy
Fiscus.
And the anchor, the reporter on that story, they asked to deliver the news to the family, which I thought was like so telling for the time how much he was watched.
Exactly. The sheriff came up to Bill Welch, who was one of the announcers, along with Stan Chambers on KTLA, and he said, "We just found out that Kathy has passed away, and the family has been watching you." That coverage was 29 hours of coverage they did. And the family has been watching you and Bill, and they feel close to you, and would it be possible for you to go in and tell them that Kathy's passed away? And he did.
There's a certain intimacy that television brought to the audience with the talent, the on-air people, who became sort of like family, and especially with kids who grew up watching these kiddie shows aimed at children, with hosts who kids identified with. They looked up to the, and these hosts would over the weekends do supermarket openings and you know, various things. They'd make all these public appearances, personal appearances, and the kids would flock. One thing we don't really talk about, though, is that they were all pitching products, and these kids hosts were, you know, potato chips or whatever it was.
Cereal.
Difference with Captain Kangaroo on the network, he wouldn't do that. He would not pitch products for his shows, which is quite a thing back then because everything was commercialized.
Let's talk about O.J., because O.J. Simpson, not the orange juice. Because here, now, in 2018, if there's a pursuit, we drop everything, send the helicopter, we're on it. And when O.J. Simpson was in that slow car chase, that was kind of what kickstarted that, correct?
Yes, it was. I think they said that 90 million people across the country were watching that. As a matter of fact, NBC was doing a basketball playoff NBA game, and somebody said, "Well, let's do a split screen. Let's have the chase on the left and the ball game on the right." And that's how important that they felt that it was. I don't know that the sports people would agree with it, but certainly the news people did. And a very interesting thing happened on that chase. We talk about cooperation, as I was talking about before, with the networks and local stations. One of the dangers of doing live helicopter coverage is if it's extended, you're going to run out of fuel. You got to go refuel.
Right.
This was the first time where the stations all agreed that if, in fact, your helicopter had to go refuel, you could use our picture. That had never happened before. It was always very, very competitive. You know, no, you can't. No, you can use our picture.
Yeah.
You know, it's our picture.
There was still some of that with, you know, the chase went along the 405.
Yeah.
And you hit the airport. Now, you can't just fly over the airport. And so people had to drop out. And
yeah.
Also, you're assigned different elevations in flight. So you're not all flying at the same level. Some choppers are way up there. Some are a little lower. And it requires a lot of coordination to get this coverage.
But that was the first time where all of the news directors in town decided that they would cooperate on this issue. The other cooperation happened when the trial started. All of the general managers got together and said, well, we want to cover it. We're going to cover the trial. And then they said, well, stupid to have seven stations covering the trial. So what they agreed on, that everybody would cover the first day, which turned out to be a bust because it's a lot of preliminary stuff that nobody cares about. And then after that, the stations would rotate. In other words, Channel 2 would do it Tuesday, Channel 4 would do it Wednesday, so that everybody had live coverage.
You had pool coverage, which was coordinated by the Radio TV News Association.
But that lasted about a week, and everyone dropped out except KTLA, and they said, we have the worst daytime programming in the history of L.A. We don't care if we dump it and just do the trial gavel to gavel. And so they did the trial, absolutely gavel to gavel, until, of course, the day of the decision, when then everyone came back in.
And, you know, the idea of covering court, which that really was when we'd had pool coverage before,
mm-hmm.
but nothing sensational like this. This case had so many sensational elements. And the judge was such a, well, we'll just say that he didn't hate the media. And in the end, everyone came in for a lot of criticism over the way the trial was covered, and the judge came in for criticism. And it has made it a lot harder for news to cover court cases, because many judges will say, I don't want to turn this trial into a media circus.
Mm.
And really, our job is to bring the courtroom to the viewers. And if you can't do that, if you can't show the citizens what's going on in their government, then we're not really able to fulfill our duty as broadcasters. It's really important for us to bring this to our viewers. The fact that you had a trial like the O.J. Simpson case that had so many sensational elements to it was, in a way, very unfortunate, because it hurt everybody, not just the news media, but it hurt the public, because the public is not able to get a good view of what goes on all the time in our courts.
Hmm. Yeah.
That's why you see so many court shows on TV now. But these are, of course... they're real judges and they're real cases, but every station has them now because people love seeing them. They're fascinating stuff.
And even before all this, we had divorce court, we had day in court,
The first court show to be big on TV was called Traffic Court, where they actually had a real judge and. Real attorneys, but the litigants were actors, but based on real cases of incidents that had happened in traffic court. And it started as a local show, and it became so popular that it eventually went to the network.
And over at Channel 11, we had, I think it was divorce court.
Yes.
And this is in the late 50s, and it's amazing, because I've seen still photos of this, and it's a set. It's not a real courtroom. It's a set. And the judge and the plaintiff, or the two parties, the drama. It's all hokey, you know. It's totally dramatized, but it was like a serial that would go from day to day to day, and people would just be riveted to their sets watching these very popular form of programming. Back
there, then. There was. I visited the set one day, and when it was time for a commercial, the stage manager on the set would hold up a sign, and it would say "Weep." And the person who was testifying would start crying, and the judge would say, let's take a break here while Mrs. Jones composes herself. And that's how they would get the commercial break.
She's on command. I love that.
Weep.
Yeah. Man. Yeah, there's so many people that I didn't realize that got their start here. I mean, like Lawrence Welk, who my grandparents loved. Regis Philbin.
Johnny Carson,
exactly. Marilyn Monroe, even.
Steve Allen. Betty White.
Betty White, Steve Allen, yeah.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. It's cool.
It was a training ground. You know, one of the major motion picture directors, Sam Peckinpah, started at Channel 13. He was a grip. Back then they had grips, people who moved the props around and to hold the cards for the commercials and all that. And he was a student at USC. He was working on his degree in cinematography, actually on his master's thesis. And he was a grip during the day at Channel 13. Well, he arranged through the station agreed to let him use the equipment overnight to shoot a little one-act Tennessee Williams play for as part of his master's thesis. And so he put his wife in it. He got all of his colleagues at work to help set this up, and he directed it, and this, and they made a kinescope of it. A kinescope, again, is just a film off of a television monitor, and it's the only way of keeping a record of what went on because they didn't have videotape back then. And so he shot this little one-act play. It runs about 10 or 15 minutes and got his master's thesis. That kinescope, that little film, is at USC. You can watch it today. You can see it. And it's amazing. He went on to a huge career in motion pictures and started here in little old local television.
Oh, local television.
Like see, that. back in the 50s, even in the 40s, all of the local stations did a lot of programming, not news programming. News was like, as I said, 15 minutes. They did variety shows, they did kids shows, they did women's shows, they did dramatic shows, they did variety shows. And every station tried to outdo the other and in scope and in budget and whatever. And audiences would watch these local shows. As soon as the news came in, all of the money that went for all those other shows disappeared. And now, you go to a local station and you say, or even one of the network affiliates, what do you do locally? Well, we do the news. Anything else? Nothing.
Nothing.
Well, you know, stations had house bands. They had musicians there to perform, to provide the music for all these shows. It's amazing.
It's so funny to think, like, if we had that right now.
Wouldn't it be great?
Yeah, actually, I first learned about, there was a lot of, like, magazine shows, because Steve used to do Two on the Town, and he was telling me about that.
Produced that.
Yeah. And it's funny, because that's sort of, I mean, shows like that exist on, like, a network level, I guess, with, like, Vice. Do you ever watch Vice?
Uh-huh.
It sort of reminds me of that, but not in a local level at
right,
all.
Right, right.
They sort of went away.
No, that was sadly, Two in the Town and Channel 7 had a similar show called Eyewitness Eye on LA. That was the last of the breed. Those shows went away.
They were expensive to do.
They got to be expensive because they were so successful that everybody got raises.
Oh, yeah.
But when we started out, it was, you know, dirt cheap. And again, nobody thought that they would ever succeed, but people enjoy shows about their own community. And that's why those shows worked. Two in the Town ran for 8 years. Eye on LA ran for 8 years. Put a lot of people to work, did a lot of stories. But it got, as Mitch said, it got to be too expensive.
And it really grew. The originally Two on the Town was to on the town.
Right.
And soon it became, not soon, but eventually it became, we're in Acapulco today. And then hey, next thing you know, it was a different town.
We always travel during sweeps. You know what sweeps are.
Got to go big.
Whenever there was sweeps, we would go travel somewhere because people enjoyed, you know, travel shows. But see, two on the town, we never said what town it was.
Yes, that's right. Now, you know, Channel 2 also had Ralph's Stories Los Angeles,
which predated
my favorite show.
Absolutely. It was a great show.
I loved how you were mentioning how it was very competitive between the news stations. And I love how they would just think of, like, I think it was KTLA that did the mystery person sitting on the tower.
Mystery tower sitter, yes.
Like, if you can guess who it is, you'll win a car.
That's right.
Or if one lucky person will broadcast the news right from your living room.
That happened. No, that actually happened. And again, these were sweeps tricks. I mean, they still... If you hear ads on the radio for a TV newscast, you know it sweeps because that's when they buy radio time.
So here's my question. What do you guys think is the future of local television?
Well,
when you think about it, like now, what it is right now and maybe sort of where it's going, what do you think about that?
The only thing it's going to do is news coverage.
Yeah.
There's not going to be any kind of major local programming. Channel 13 used to do the Hollywood Bowl concerts. Gone.
You know, it's funny. I started here in 2014, and I didn't realize that Channel 13 was its own.
Mm-hmm.
Because by the time I started, it was Seinfeld, I Love Lucy. I mean, you know, it was syndicated shows.
Well, Channel 13 was the first of the original stations to dump their newscast. But before that, as I say... Hollywood Bowl. Why not televise the Hollywood Bowl? You know, but no station picked it up. The only thing that stations do now, not as many as used to, is the Rose Parade. Everyone covers that.
Right.
But aside from that, some occasional sports coverage. Most of the sports coverage is on cable, as you know. It's just news.
Yeah,
and they just do news.
News is news, and people are going to want to know what's going on in their communities, and it doesn't matter what the platform is. Right now, we have a multitude of ways of watching newscasts, and mobile TV certainly is probably going to be the dominant, I think, eventually. But as we look at it today, what we are doing is going out into the community, finding out what's happening, and telling an audience, our viewers, the community, letting them know what's going on. And I don't think that's going to change. I think that mission is going to remain. How we get it to people, that changes. That always changes. Technology evolves. It's what we live with because, very fortunately, we have the means to evolve.
And the other irony is if a local station wanted to do something, let's say they wanted to do a big musical special someday, they can't even do it in their own studio because... The only studios that are around now from the local stations are for the newscast.
Right.
They'd have to go rent a building somewhere to do it. It used to be that everyone had enough room to do these kinds of shows, the kids shows and the game shows and the women's shows and all of that. But no more.
That kind of programming, it doesn't exist anymore. I do remember when Putnam had his audience... And for he had a show over at 5 for a while. Putnam worked at these two stations, Channel 11 and Channel 5. Highest paid anchor. I mean, he was making Cronkite money back in the 70s. And he had a show called Talk Back, and he did that over at 5 with an audience. First you do a little newscast, and then you have someone in the dock who tries to get George engaged in some kind of hostile conversation, and pretty soon they're you know, rooting for... That was a lot of fun to do the show like that. And I thought, well, gee, wouldn't it be interesting if you had a newscast and you had bleachers and people could come in and watch the news? But really...
It's too dangerous now, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's to your point about the mission of local news, I think that's what keeps it relevant. Because the fact that I can, if I want to know something, I don't have to wait until 5 o'clock to turn on my TV. It's like obviously very accessible on the internet. But local news to me is a lot of times it's stories that I wouldn't even know to search for. You know, it's like it's bringing you stuff that that is relevant to you because it's around where you live. So yeah, I think you're definitely
here's the problem all stations are dealing with. Young people do not watch news on television, and so they try and cater their newscasts to attract young people, but the fact is the young people are not going to watch. Yeah. So the older folks get upset because they're not interested either on certain kinds of stories.
Right. So it's like you're not winning anyone then. Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting kind of dilemma.
It used to be that the whole family would sit around and watch the 6 o'clock news.
Yeah.
Those days are gone. But there is a news audience. Unfortunately, it's kind of elderly.
Yeah.
And you can tell that by the commercials that they run. It's all kinds of medicines and whatever. You know, any disease that's treatable, you'll see a commercial for on the newscast.
A lot of viewers aren't quite that old, but I mean news is relevant to the person when they have a stake in their community. If you have a mortgage, if you have a job, you want to know if you're going to be working next week. Mm-hmm.
If there's a fire burning.
This is stuff that people need. It doesn't matter what their age is. And they will gravitate to the source of that information.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, really, we're the only ones who are equipped to provide that kind of information authoritatively. Sure, somebody can go up on Facebook and say, this is... But there's no way of knowing if it's accurate or not. We do work to make sure it's accurate. Mm-hmm. We do check our sources. We do verify before we put this on the air. So there is that, and it makes it valuable, and it makes it valuable as a resource for the community, for viewers, no matter what their ages are, because we are providing that service, and no one else is really doing it that way.
Yeah. Well, I think you're also doing a service in just that. I know you guys spoke at the library, and you wrote this book, and just... like making sure that some of this stuff doesn't go forgotten, you know? Because I didn't know a bunch of this stuff, and it makes me be because we even have photos in our hallways of the original Channel 11 and people that were here, and it just, I don't know, it makes it more interesting to me.
Well, let me just tell you quickly, nothing against Channel 11, but when I started doing this book, I contacted all of the original seven stations, and I said, I'm writing this book. If you have any historical photos, I would love to be able to include them with proper credit so that I can tell the whole story. Only two stations responded. Channel 5, because I worked there and had a lot of the stills. And Channel 4, because they helped support the museum in Chicago, which sponsored this book. Never heard from 11, never heard from 13, never heard from 2, never heard from 7. Wouldn't you think they would want to be included? But if they were not there when all of this history was being made, they really don't care about it.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. I mean,
and then I found out Warren Cherogino said to me, "Oh, we got all kinds of historic photos on the walls." I said, "Well, how come I didn't know about it?"
Well, you should have called me. But there's so much.
Well, no, Mitch supplied a number of stills that he had in his personal collection.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And if that wasn't there, then Channel 13 and Channel 11 would not have been represented at all.
Mitch.
Well, I did an anniversary show for 13 about 20 years ago, and so I did a lot of research back then, and I went through all the libraries and I made photocopies of the newspaper articles and all this, and very fortunately was able to reach people who were still around, who had started in the early days at all these TV stations, interviewed a lot of them, and came away with a lot of their mementos. For instance, we talk about Liberace, as a matter of fact, who started in Los Angeles on Channel 13, and his director, a fellow named Jim Hobson, later left to become Lawrence Welk's producer and director for all of his career. But Jim had in his closet the original title card that was used for the Liberace show. And he had a cigarette case, Liberace had signed, all this junk. And so I collected all this ephemera and all this stuff from people who were there at the time. And as a result, I had all this stuff. And it interests me because it's history and it's something that belongs in a museum.
Yeah. I've always loved history, too, and just learning about it. Because, like I said before, it makes you appreciate what we're doing right now. All the people who came before you that risked their life to set up a live shot from an atomic testing site to, you know what I mean? I mean, it's just, it's cool. It's good. Before you guys leave, do you guys have smart TVs at home? No?
I do, but mine is purposely not using its intelligence.
Oh, it's not?
I have a smart TV. I have two, as a matter of fact. But I don't route any of that through. Because
like
I
don't watch Netflix on it or Hulu or something. Gotcha.
I have a stupid TV.
Oh, stupid not TV.
You have a CRT.
I have a CRT. I have the last model made of the cathode ray tube. Nobody uses tubes anymore. TV.
So...
I mean, the other sets are pixels and, you know, all kinds of, but the set weighs about 500 pounds.
Does it make a noise when you turn it on?
No,
it's like,
no.
You know what I'm talking about?
Well, it may. I haven't noticed but it. I'll check it out.
It gets so hot you could cook an omelet on top of it.
But to me, that's a first generation picture. In other words, I have an antenna so I can see Mount Wilson. I also have satellite, but I can get a picture right from the mountain and into my tube, and it's as clear as it's going to get.
Yeah, it's cool.
No interference.
What's old is new again.
I have a 4K set and an antenna connected to it so I can watch over the air, uncompressed or at least less compressed than what you would get when you have it set up through cable or through a dish, because they're squeezing that image, and you see all this weird pixelation and stuff. You don't get that when you're watching it all.
Also, if you watch it on an antenna, as opposed to cable, you get it a few seconds earlier.
That's true.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, because it is a big process through their antenna and their retransmission.
So if you're like watching the Super Bowl, you can get the outcome.
You know,
three seconds earlier.
It 3 seconds before anyone else.
That's great. It cracks me up. Does it?
Oh, it looks a lot. It does look better. If your eye is accustomed to looking at TV images, it looks much better when it's over the air.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to put my bunny ears to use tonight. In
fact, well, you have to be able to see Mount Wilson where you live. Do you?
Ooh.
Can you?
I live in Hermosa.
Yeah, I think you get a clear shot.
See, I lived in Pasadena for a while, right in the shadow of Wilson, and I couldn't get.
Really?
13 was just kind of off and on. I was too close, the shadow.
You know, it cracks me up. Have you noticed, this is not television, but have you noticed that speaking of like sort of older things like record players or Polaroid cameras, they're very popular now.
Vinyl is back.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, there's women's clothing stores that sell Polaroid cameras for a lot of money. And it's like I said, what's old is new again. It's like all coming back. Vinyl is so popular now.
Yeah, turntables. People are buying turntables.
Right. Yeah.
As a record collector, I think it's interesting. You go to a record shop and you see the reissues or the new issues on vinyl. And I said, yes, but it's digital vinyl. It's not really analog. It's analog in the sense that you're going to play it back with a stylus. But all of the equipment made to record that is digital, pretty much, unless they go out of their way to record in an analog way. They try to emulate analog sound. They try to soften the curve so it has a smoother sound.
You know what I think is interesting, just having not grown up using a record player, and now when I'm around it, is the fact that you end up listening to the whole record. Because I'm of the generation that I would just play a song, and then especially on my phone, I mean, I'll play this song, I'll skip around, play that song. And what's nice about something like an album on a record is like on a record player is that you just end up listening to the whole thing, and it really makes you appreciate the flow of music from start to finish that you don't have anymore. So maybe that's like maybe one reason why.
Well, they had, you know, concept albums came out. Actually, they started in the early 60s, but rock and roll really took this concept album thing where the whole album was meant to be played from beginning to end, and it was one song was related to the next. And, you know, the Beatles did that. And
who?
You Yes, right. Yeah.
Who are they? All right. Well, thank you guys very much for coming in and taking the time to talk about this. It's honestly, I feel like I learned so much, and I work at a TV station, so this is great. So thank
you. Our pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to the Olympic and Bundy podcast. If you enjoyed the show or learned something, share it with a friend. Maybe you know someone in TV or film or grew up here in LA who might appreciate listening to this. If you haven't already, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Play. The episodes are also available at olympicandbundy.com. I'm Kelly Taylor, and thanks again for listening.